From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
By participating in free elections, the Iraqi people have firmly rejected the anti-democratic ideology of the terrorists.
An election held under foreign military occupation is always, by definition, utterly flawed, but one which is held in the kind of conditions in which this one is being held is flawed beyond redemption.
Thousands of Kurds of all ages mill around, waiting for their chance to queue up. Others push forward to try to get to the front, prompting local Peshmerga fighters to push them back, firing bullets into the air.
What do I do with democracy? Does it allow me to walk right across the street without being feared of being kidnapped or being shot at or being mugged or being stolen? Would democracy feed my children?
Today, the Iraqi elections. We'll get a report from Baghdad, from Kurdistan, from Washington and London. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, millions of voters took part Sunday in election to form the country's new National Assembly, the first contested election in Iraq in half a century. Iraqi election officials initially put the turnout at 72%, but it emerged later the actual turnout was closer to 57%. An estimated 8 million of the country's 14 million eligible voters took part. In the Kurdish area, turnout was reported to be over 90%, but in certain Sunni areas, the polls never even opened. The final results are not expected for another 10 days, but preliminary results could be released today. In Baghdad, poll workers began counting ballots Sunday night, but needed to do so by candlelight due to ongoing electricity outages. Although Iraq is in a state of lockdown, Iraqi fighters carried out about 175 attacks, killing 44 people. While turnout appeared higher than expected, journalist Robert Fisk reports the turnout should be seen as both a victory and a tragedy. He writes, quote, "For while the Shias voted in the millions with immense courage, the Sunni voice of Iraq remains silent, casting into semi-legitimacy the National Assembly." Fisk went on to report no one he spoke to expects the resistance to end and that many fear it will grow more ferocious if the Sunnis are underrepresented in the new Shiite and Kurdish-led government. Earlier today, interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi vowed to begin a, quote, national dialogue to guarantee that voices of all Iraqis are present in the coming government. In Washington, President Bush called the election a resounding success. He said, quote, "The world's hearing the voice of freedom from the center of the Middle East." Meanwhile, former presidential candidate John Kerry questioned the election's legitimacy. He told Tim Russert on Meet the Press, quote, "It's hard to say something's legitimate when whole portions of the country can't vote and doesn't vote." In opposition to the presence of 150,000 U.S. troops in Iraq remains high throughout the country. A new Zoghbi poll shows that 82% of Sunni and 69% of Shia now favor U.S. forces withdrawing either immediately or after an elected government is in place. While the Bush administration praised the elections, the vote was not well received at the World Social Forum in Brazil. On Sunday, an anti-war assembly endorsed a call for global protests against the U.S. war to be held on March 20th. One Iraqi Shiite leader at the forum, Sheikh Jawad Khalisi, said, quote, "These elections are not elections for the Iraqi people, but for George Bush." Patrick Coburn of The Independent reported from Baghdad several Iraqis interviewed said they saw the election like a movie directed by the Americans to impress the outside world. One unemployed carpenter said, quote, "It's like a film. Whatever happens, it's the Americans who will control the next government." The election took place under extraordinary security provisions. Iraq's borders were shut down. A dusk-to-dawn curfew was in effect. Motor vehicle traffic was mostly banned. Many candidates never even publicly announced their candidacy out of fear. Election Day also turned out to be the deadliest day to date for Britain since the start of the Iraq War. Up to 15 British soldiers died when a cargo airplane crashed north of Baghdad on Sunday. The cause of the crash is unknown, but the Independent of London reports there was speculation that a surface-to-air missile brought down the aircraft. Earlier today, the militant group Ansar al-Islam claimed it shot down the plane. In other news from Iraq, new figures compiled by the Iraqi government show that since July of last year, U.S. forces and their counterparts have been responsible for the majority of civilians killed in Iraq. According to Iraq's Ministry of Health, just under 3,300 civilians were killed between July and December. Of those killed, just over 2,000 were killed by the U.S.-led coalition and Iraqi forces, about 1,200 killed in attacks carried out by Iraqi fighters. And a new audit has found the U.S. government cannot account for $9 billion that it purportedly transferred to Iraqi governmental ministries. The audit determined there was no way to verify how the money was spent. And in other news, four of the largest media corporations here in the United States have asked the Supreme Court to review a lower court ruling that's blocked the companies from greatly expanding. The media companies filed the appeal on Friday, a day after the Bush administration announced it would not appeal the court ruling. Viacom, which owns CBS, General Electric, which owns NBC, News Corp, which owns Fox, and the Tribune Company filed a joint petition with the Supreme Court with the hopes that the High Court would rule the Federal Communications Commission can go ahead and implement a series of sweeping media ownership rule changes that would lead to dramatic consolidation of the country's media outlets. If the Supreme Court backs the media companies, a single company would soon be allowed to own as many as 3 television stations, 8 radio stations, a cable operator, and a newspaper in a single city. In other media news, the Arab nation of Qatar is considering selling off its stake in the satellite news station Al Jazeera. This comes after the U.S. has long complained to its ally in the Persian Gulf about Al Jazeera's news coverage. In Sudan, police and troops opened fire on a group of demonstrators Sunday, killing at least 18 people. The incident occurred in Port Sudan, a city in eastern Sudan on the Red Sea. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, the state legislature has voted to divest New Jersey's pension fund investments from companies that do business with Sudan. The vote comes in response to the human rights abuses being carried out in the Darfur region. In business news, Vice President Dick Cheney's former company, Halliburton, has announced it'll soon stop doing business in Iran, where it's operated for years, despite a U.S. trade embargo. Halliburton's currently the largest private contractor in Iran. The company bypassed the trade embargo by setting up a subsidiary in the Cayman Islands to deal with Iran. The number of prominent conservative columnists who were quietly paid off by the Bush administration is now at least 3. Salon.com is reporting Michael McManus received $10,000 to promote the Bush administration's Community Healthy Marriage Initiative. Earlier in the month, it was disclosed that both Armstrong Williams and Maggie Gallagher were also on the government payroll. The state of Connecticut is scheduled tonight to become the first New England state in 45 years to carry out an execution. Confessed killer Michael Ross is scheduled to die at 9 p.m., but his lawyers plan to file last-minute challenges to ask a court to determine if Ross is mentally competent. Meanwhile, Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold has introduced a bill to abolish the federal death penalty. Feingold noted that since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976, at least 100 prisoners on death row were found to be innocent. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Millions of Iraqis turned out to cast ballots Sunday in the country's first multi-party elections in half a century. At least 44 people were killed, over 100 wounded in suicide bombings, shootings, and mortar attacks. The attacks came amid unprecedented levels of security, including shoot-on-site curfews, closed foreign borders, a ban on cars, and travel restrictions within Iraq. Iraqi voters headed to more than 30,000 polling stations set up across the country, with the polling beginning at 7 a.m., ending at 5 p.m. Election officials originally said 72% of the country's 13 million registered voters turned out to vote. They later revised the number to 8 million, or just over 60%. With foreign monitors mostly staying away for fear of kidnapping, it was difficult to assess the fairness of the election or accuracy of the turnout estimates. But the UN's electoral advisor in Iraq, Carlos Valenzuela, said he's encouraged by early indications. Meanwhile, at a news conference in Washington, President Bush hailed the elections as a resounding success.
By participating in free elections, the Iraqi people have firmly rejected the anti-democratic ideology of the terrorists. They have refused to be intimidated by thugs and assassins. And they have demonstrated the kind of courage that is always the foundation of self-government. Some Iraqis were killed while exercising their rights as citizens. We also mourn the American and British military personnel who lost their lives today. Their sacrifices were made in a vital cause of freedom, peace in a troubled region, and a more secure future for us all. The Iraqi people themselves made this election a resounding success.
President Bush, speaking yesterday at the White House, while officials in Washington hailed the Iraq elections as a resounding success in democracy, a marked division in voting turnout within Iraq. The turnout was high in Shia and Kurdish-dominated regions, but in Sunni areas, the number of voters was much lower. We turn now to Baghdad, to independent reporter Robert Fisk. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Robert.
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe what you have experienced over the last day?
Well, I have to say, as a person who is regularly cynical about the Middle East, and I think with good reason, it was a very moving experience to see so many hundreds and thousands of Shia Muslims in Baghdad walking against the sound of bombs and mortar fire. I counted 30 incoming mortar rounds quite close to us as I walked to one polling station in Jadriya within 2 minutes. All these families, sometimes bringing along their children, carrying their babies in their arms, going to vote. The Shiites decided to vote. They abided by the instructions of the supreme Shiite leader, the Marja, Ali al-Sistani, who said it was more important to vote than fasting at Ramadan or prayer. And when you went into the polling stations, you could talk to them. The American-appointed administration insisted that television cameras could only film in five polling stations. Four of them, naturally, were Shiite, which were nearly crowded with voters, and one was upper-class Sunni, which would have some voters, and none for lower-class Sunni areas, where, of course, there wouldn't be any. But we could move around as newspaper journalists quite freely and go from polling station to polling station. And we had to walk because the roads were closed. There was no traffic except for American military patrols and Iraqi police. And, you know, to see these people coming as one, as families, with all their identification papers and dutifully having the indelible ink put on their fingers to prevent fraud at the polls, and then going to vote, almost all of them in my area here for the Iraqi alliance, the Shiite Iraqi alliance. It showed that, you know, here we were, you could feel the air pressure changing with explosions of mortars, and the first two suicide bombers blew themselves up not far from us, killing at least nine of the almost 50 people who were to be killed in the past 24 hours. And there they were, they queued and went through the security checks and voted. And that, I suppose, is what we want people to do. The catch, of course, is that the Shiites were not voting for democracy, although they'd very much like to have it and believe in it. Many of them expressed their views very forthrightly inside the polling stations. They said, "We're coming to vote because our Marja, alias Sunni, told us to. We're coming to vote because we weren't allowed to do so before. And we're coming to vote because we want the Americans to leave." Now, it's all very well for the American media to say they came to vote for democracy. They probably did, but they also came because they think and believe and are convinced of the fact that by voting, they will have a free country without an occupation force. If they are denied this, if they feel that they are betrayed, that their vote is worth nothing, of course, a different question arises. What will they think of democracy, and will they join the insurgency? The Kurds, of course, voted for their own autonomy, and they are the most pro-American of all Iraqis. And in a sense, you see, although they voted in an Iraqi election, they were, in a sense, trying to continue to vote themselves out of Iraq. The more autonomy they had, and the flags you saw in the streets of Kurdistan were Kurdish, not Iraqi, the nearer they are to the independence which Kurdish people have been demanding for so many decades, indeed, you know, at least 200 years. So what you got was an election which showed immense courage on behalf of the Shiites, perhaps less courage on the Kurds, who anyway live in the most stable area of Iraq, but nonetheless they went up to vote and they have been threatened in the past, and a total abstention, virtually total abstention, by Sunni Muslims. And the latter, of course, is this is the problem. If there is to be a national assembly which is genuinely representative of the Iraqi people, and this election was not for a government but for an assembly to choose a constitution upon which there must be a referendum before there is another election for a new government, sorry to bore you with that, but it's true, then what is the legitimacy of a new parliament if 20% of the population, the only section of the population which is actively and violently resisting the Americans, is not represented? This is the real problem, you see. Either the Shiites are going to find themselves betrayed because what they want is not going to be forthcoming. Of course, they want to run the next government. They want to be, they would like this to be a Shia country. It doesn't mean they want everyone to be Shia. They don't want an Islamic Republic. But they want power because they're 60% of the population, and for 100 years they've not been able to be represented in government in that way. So what this election has done, it has not actually been a demonstration of people who demand democracy. They want freedom of a different kind, freedom to vote, but also freedom from foreign occupation. And if they are betrayed in this, then we are going to look back and regret the broken promises. But certainly, even the Iraqi soldiers guarding one of the polling stations, and the fact that they were all wearing black hoods so they couldn't be identified, tells you the dismal sense of security here. Said the same thing, we want the Americans to go. But, of course, we're not seeing any promises to do that. And Ayad Alawi, the Prime Minister, who, of course, was a former CIA agent and was appointed by the Americans, who may well be reappointed with their assistance as head of a coalition new government after the parliament is formed, all he says is we don't want the Americans to leave yet, but this is a great victory over terrorism. It was very interesting yesterday morning from his bunker-like office, in the so-called green zone, where he's protected by the Americans and the British, he solemnly and publicly on television cast his vote and urged all Iraqis to go and vote like he did. But of course, they can't vote like he did. They had to go out into the streets where there was a lot of danger from suicide bombings and mortars, whereas Mr. Alawi was quite safe. But that's part of the pattern of life in Iraq now. But again, I repeat, it was a very moving thing to see so many Shiites, and of course, this was also repeated in other cities, particularly in Basra in the south, and Najaf and Kerbala and Kufa, taking their entire families, walking silently through the streets, as I say, as the air pressure changed with explosions, and just heading in silence to the polling station because they had made a decision that they would vote, whatever. Very impressive.
We have to break, but when we come back, I want to ask you, Robert Fisk, about Kurdistan and a report in your competitor in The Guardian of London that possibly Iraq could soon have its first Kurdish president or prime minister, with discussions going on between the two Kurdish leaders saying they would demand one of the two top offices. We're talking to Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper. He's speaking to us from Baghdad, where the elections have just concluded. Stay with us. Jihan and Kamian, just you and I, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're talking to Robert Fisk of the Independent London, long-term Middle East correspondent, now back in Baghdad, covering the elections. This latest report on the possibility of perhaps a prime minister or president being Kurdish. Robert Fisk.
Right. Well, if you hear the noise in the background, excuse me, there are some of your helicopters passing over me here. I don't think it's an issue whether the Kurdish Kurds may be a prime minister or president. That's always possible. The issue is, what is going to be the American involvement in providing Iraq with its next interim government? Again, I repeat, this election was for a National Assembly to write a constitution which would have to be approved by a referendum, which in December there would then have to be another election for a real, quote-unquote, government. The issue here, you see, is this. In the aftermath of these elections, and we don't know the results, and we won't know them for days to come, it is quite possible that the administration here, which of course is effectively in the hands of the United States, and here Ambassador Negroponte would be involved, will try to form a government coalition. This would include certain leading Shiite politicians who won seats in yesterday's election. It would include some Sunnis who were running, in some cases, on Shia tickets. This was a list system, proportional representation election. And, of course, it would undoubtedly include some Kurds. Now, it would look very nice and democratic and free if a coalition government could include Shiites and Sunnis and Kurds. And that, I'm sure, is what the Americans would like to see. But then the largest Shiite alliance, which scored seats in the election, could turn out to be the official opposition. And Shiites would then say, well, it's very nice to have this lovely coalition of all our ethnic groups, but we won the election, we are 60% of the people, and now we're in a coalition where we don't have the majority of power, and our largest party is confined to being the opposition in parliament. And that, at the moment, is the biggest danger, that we're going to see such administrative refining of the results that we will produce an, in westernized, infinitely fair coalition government comprising Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds, but which will not represent the overall election results, which must show a Shiite majority. I mean, there are actually members of the largest alliance of Shiite groups saying now that they are certain they've got more than 50% of the vote, which was cast yesterday. Now, if that's the case, the Shiites will say, well, hold on a second. We're the majority. We got the most votes. We got the greatest number of seats. And you're making us part of a coalition and the biggest party in the opposition in parliament. And that, of course, for them would be betrayal, just as it would be if they suddenly find that the Americans and the British and the other foreign forces here are not going to leave. So we've actually, I mean, we've set up an enormous amount of expectations for this election. And you've got to admit, I have to admit, having seen it and been there and walked with people to the polling stations in Baghdad, that the Shiites who wanted to vote did so unanimously and with great courage. Are they now going to be betrayed by the slippery process of coalitioning a government which will suit the West, which will, of course, include Kurds and will, of course, must include some Sunnis as well? Or are they going to be effectively told, okay, the Shiites now have what you people in America like to call empowerment. This is now effectively a Shiite republic, not an Islamic republic, but this country is a Shiite country, which it is, of course, in real life. Will the election results, will the parliament, will the next government actually reflect the reality on the ground? If it does, then we're moving. If it doesn't, then it would be better that the elections had not been held.
Robert Fisk, I want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Baghdad on this day after the Iraqi elections. Robert Fisk, longtime Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper in Britain. As we turn now to the north of Iraq, as we turn now to a report from Kurdistan, it was Kurds making up about 20% of the population, voting in large numbers. In addition to choosing a national assembly and governing councils in the 18 provinces, Kurdish voters are also selected their own legislature. Pacifica reporter Aaron Glantz is in Iraqi Kurdistan. He filed this report.
Dozens of buses and battered Toyota pickups arrive in the small Kurdish farming village of Pir Daoud, southwest of Erbil, the regional capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. The truck beds are full of Kurds headed to the polls. The buses are full, too, furnished with giant Kurdish flags on their outside. At 9 a.m., the polling station at Pir Daoud is mobbed. Thousands of Kurds of all ages mill around, waiting for their chance to queue up. Others push forward to try to get to the front, prompting local Peshmerga fighters to push them back, firing bullets into the air. Rashid Pirbal is a 70-year-old farmer. He's dressed in traditional baggy sherwal pants and wears a checkered black and white keffiyeh.
We were killed by Arabs and they took our honor. Now we feel like we are alive and we are human. This is a different situation. We are no longer under the control of Arab people. We are Kurds and we must vote for Kurdish people.
Kurds are expecting large gains from the weekend's election. Since Kurds are pro-American and the Kurdish area is more secure than the rest of the country, Kurdish turnout was likely to be higher than their Arab counterparts. After the election, Kurdish leaders plan to take control of the oil-rich city of Kirkuk, a city which tens of thousands of Kurds were forced to leave under Saddam's regime. Already thousands of Kurds who were forced out of Kirkuk in the 80s have returned to the city. Today, 500 Kurdish families live in Kirkuk's municipal football stadium, more than double a year ago. Hadi Ali Amin lost two of her sons in Saddam Hussein's Anfal campaign.
An NGO organization has helped us with running water and some carpets, but we don't say amen to these things. I have lost two sons and I can lose two more, but this is our grandfather's land.
A week before the election, 100,000 Kurds forced to leave Kirkuk during Saddam's presidency were given the right to vote in Kirkuk's election, prompting Arab political parties in the city to launch a boycott. Kurds demand that all Arabs brought to Kirkuk by Saddam leave the city, and Arabs in Kirkuk say Kurds are now attempting their own campaign of ethnic cleansing. Perhaps the greatest irony of the election in Kurdistan, then, is the presence of Ba'athis on the Kurdish election slate. Like all election lists in Iraq, the identity of Kurdish candidates was made secret for security reasons. Unlike other election lists, however, the contents of the Kurdish list became known when it was obtained by the independent Kurdish weekly newspaper Hawlati, which found about a dozen Kurdish candidates were former Ba'athists. Zirak Abdullah is managing editor of the newspaper's Erbil office.
These are people who helped Saddam in his campaign against the Kurds. Remember that 182,000 people were killed in the Anfal campaign, which was done by Saddam in the 1980s, including what happened in Halabja. And these people, they have the blood of the Kurdish people on their hands.
Among the former Ba'athists on the Kurds' election list are former members of Saddam's village guards and the heads of Saddam's Kurdish militias, who in the 80s destroyed thousands of Kurdish villages, mainly around Kirkuk. Most Kurds found the report hard to believe, since they voted for the Kurdish list specifically to put Saddam's dictatorship behind them. Zorab Hussein was forced to leave Kirkuk in 1974, when the first Kurdish revolt against the Ba'ath collapsed. Now he lives on the outskirts of Kirkuk in a squatter's camp with no toilet facilities. His 8-year-old son plays amid human excrement.
You know Kurds are living in squalor. I don't have a door. I just have a curtain to act like a door, so how can you allow Ba'athists to be on our list at election time? If you were in my situation, would you allow Ba'athists to be on my election list?
But Zirak Abdullah of Hawlati newspaper says he's not surprised that Ba'athists have made it onto the Kurdish slate. In the 1990s, the two leading Kurdish factions, the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, fought a civil war. Both sides, desperate to rule the entire Kurdish region, called on Ba'athists for help. The Patriotic Union of Kurdistan called on Saddam's Kurdish supporters, while the Kurdistan Democratic Party invited the Iraqi army to Erbil to break the stalemate.
As we know, the PDK and PUK are the most powerful parties in Kurdistan, and in the past there was a conflict between them, and each one went to the devil to deal with the other. So those former Baathist people, they killed thousands of people, but because these two parties wanted to have more people and more followers, they tried to work with their enemy in order to bring them against the other side. Now it's payback time.
On election day, though, Kurds had little choice but to vote for these Baathists. All the Kurdish candidates were running on the same list, called the Democratic Patriotic Alliance of Kurdistan. For Democracy Now!, I'm Aaron Glantz in Erbil, Iraq.
And this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we move from Kurdistan back to Baghdad to get response from retired Iraqi engineer Ghassan al-Mukhtar. Throughout key points of the invasion and occupation, we have checked in with him on the first anniversary of the invasion, the siege of Fallujah, the so-called transfer of sovereignty on June 28th. Today, we get his thoughts on the elections. We reached him just before the program. This is Ghassan al-Mukhtar at his home in Baghdad.
I do not believe that the election is legitimate. The election is held under the occupation. The occupying power has modified the basic rules on Iraq as to who is an Iraqi and who is not. The election was shoved down our throat because all the major parties, including Alawi's party, requested that the election be postponed. That was in November. And before even the Independent Electoral Commission could decide on the request, President Bush said he does not want the election to be postponed. And Ambassador Negroponte said, oddly enough, came from Fallujah. He was in Fallujah and declared that the election will be held on the June 30th. It's an Iraqi election. It's not a U.S. election. It is not Negroponte's election. It's the Iraqi people's election. So if the Iraqi parties wanted to postpone the election, they should have been able to do so without the interference of the U.S. government. Anyway, having done the election now, which was forced down our throat, a lot of people have boycotted it. The Sunnis have boycotted the election. Some of the Shiites boycotted it. Muqtada Sadr faction boycotted the election. Al-Khalafi faction boycotted the election. There is a resistance to the occupation in Iraq. This resistance stems from the fact that our life has been, for the last 22 months, deteriorating day and night, and we have not seen any improvement in our condition for the last 22 months. No building has been reconstructed. The system, the telephone system is bad. The electricity is worse. The security condition is worse. A lot of people saying, why do I vote? What did the government do for me? They did absolutely nothing. The shocking thing is that the conditions after 22 months of occupation is a lot worse in every single aspect of life than under the Saddam Hussein after 12 years of sanction. While I'm talking to you, I just heard two bombs exploding not too far from here. I did not vote. And I will not vote to any one of those people who came on the back of the American tanks. I do not see any change because there is no will to reconstruct anything. There is no will to improve the life of Iraqis. It is going to take another 2 years and a lot of will. Mind you, in 1991, with a huge destruction in Iraq, we, the Iraqi people, despite the sanctions and with no help from anybody, we were able to restore the electricity, we were able to restore the water, the sewage, And in 6 months, we were able to rebuild the country in less than a year. Now, that time has gone. The U.S. have had the 22 months occupation, and they have not fixed a single thing in Iraq. We are still getting 2,200 calories on the ration system. We were told that Saddam Hussein was stealing our money, building the palaces, and keeping us poor and hungry. Well, now, after 22 months, we're still getting 2,200 calories or sometimes less. Halliburton, we have added crisis right now of petrol. Iraq was an exporting country of diesel fuel and refined oil products. Since the occupation, we have been importing oil from Turkey. No one fixed the refineries. There's a huge queue of cars waiting to get oil or petrol. In the Congress, the U.S. Congress said in 2003, May 2003, 7 out of 18 governorates had more than 16 hours of electricity. Now we are getting 2 hours of electricity right in Baghdad. I'm lucky today I have the electricity from 7 to 9. And that's going to be all. Until late in the evening, maybe, I don't know when, I'll get the electricity. So all those factors will indicate that the people are discontent, the people are resentful of the presence of the American forces, that that the people are dissatisfied with the occupation because they have not seen any improvement in their life. Unemployment is very high. It's at about 60%. People are starving. This is the basis for the resistance. It's not the Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, and it's not Abu, I don't know who, or the terrorists coming from the outside of Iraq. It's the indigenous Iraqi resistance. While we were told that Saddam Hussein was torturing us, we are finding after 22 months that the Americans are torturing us, the British are torturing us, the Danish are torturing us, and now we discover that the Iraqi forces, the IMG, is torturing us. So instead of having one torturer, now we have four torturers. And you want us to be happy with the election. This reminds me of a story when Marie Antoinette was asked, she was told that the people did not have bread to eat. She said, why don't they eat cake? We don't have anything. And they tell us, here it is, democracy. Take democracy. What do I do with democracy? Does it allow me to walk right across the street without being feared of being kidnapped or being shot at or being mugged or being stolen? Would democracy feed my children? Would democracy allow me to quench my thirst? The U.S. has not done anything at all to improve the life of Iraqi people. And that is one of the reasons why you are seeing all those attacks.
Ghassan al-Mukhtar, a retired Iraqi engineer, speaking from his home in Baghdad. When we come back, we'll hear from British MP George Galloway, and then in our own studios, Christian Parente, author of the new book, The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq. Stay with us.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 300 radio and television stations around the country, Pacifica and NPR stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and on both satellite TV networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV as well, Channel 375. We're also broadcasting video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. The elections in Iraq have been hailed as a resounding success, both by President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair. In a brief statement from 10 Downing Street, Blair said, quote, "Democracy in Iraq is not just good for Iraq itself. It's also a blow right to the heart of the global terrorism that threatens destruction, not just in Iraq, but in Britain and virtually every major country in the world." Not all British government officials feel the same way. Scottish MP George Galloway has been one of the most vocal critics of the Iraq war. He was expelled by his own ruling party, the Labour Party, in October 2003 after he was accused of encouraging British troops to disobey what he called illegal orders. Well, yesterday I was in England and Ireland as part of the International Exception to the Rulers book tour with my colleague, Democracy Now! Producer Elizabeth Press. Yesterday in London, we bumped into George Galloway outside of BBC studios and asked him about his thoughts on the Iraqi elections.
They're a farce. They're rigged. An election held under foreign military occupation is always, by definition, utterly flawed. But one which is held in the kind of conditions in which this one is being held is flawed beyond redemption. The facts are that it is simply impossible to hold an election when there's a full-scale war going on between the occupying armies and the resistance forces. The Sunni Muslim population, which if you add the Sunni Kurds and the Sunni Arabs together is some 40% of the population, are deeply anxious about the way in which the occupying forces are deliberately trying to divide the country along confessional lines. The Sunni Arab population has boycotted the election almost in their entirety. The Iraqis living outside, for whom security was not an issue, three quarters of them have voted with their feet and boycotted the election. Less than a quarter of the eligible voters have registered to vote, and fewer still have cast their votes. So this is a festival, a farce, that's been held to validate the American-British invasion and occupation of Iraq. But it will not validate it, neither in the eyes of the world opinion, nor, more importantly, in the eyes of those Iraqis who are resisting the foreign occupation. And the war will go on, I'm sorry to say.
So what do you see is going to happen, and what are you calling for?
Well, there's a very great danger of what I call the Yugoslavization of Iraq, the petrifying of the population on ethnic and confessional lines, and the country beginning a process of breaking up into three Iraqs, which is itself pregnant with many real dangers for the surrounding countries, not just Arab countries, but Turkey and Iran, which could very well lead to fighting over oil resources and a spreading of the conflagration which already exists there. We have a very simple demand. We say that the two leaders who caused this disaster cannot possibly be a part of its solution. Bush and Blair and their forces will have to go from Iraq. That's an absolute precondition for any resolution of this conflict, and they must talk with the resistance about how they're going to do that, over what period of time. It'd have to be a short period of time, but I'm sure it could be organized by agreement with the resistance forces. That sounds far-fetched today, but it will one day have to be agreed. Just like the American forces had to withdraw from Vietnam, so the American and British forces will have to withdraw from Iraq.
And what about the population in Britain now? And what about today? Here we are at the BBC, hearing all day the voices of people talking about going to vote and how exhilarated they are.
Well, we would like all the people of the Arab world to be able to go and vote in democratic elections. That's why, if we'd been alive, we would have opposed the British and French and other European colonization of Arab countries, where, incidentally, there was never a single election held that could remotely be described as a free and fair election. And it's why we're against all the dictatorships in the Arab world, who rule the Arab world, almost without exception, from the Atlantic to the Gulf, mostly with the full support of Britain and the United States. And we want democratic elections in Iraq too, but these are not democratic elections, and these elections will solve nothing and may even add to the problems. But in Britain, now 29% of the population support the Iraq war, down from something like 68% at the height of the fighting and the fall of the regime in Baghdad. That's a pretty spectacular fall, and it will fall further still.
Finally, was it the Times of London, which newspaper settled with you and apologized?
Well, how long have you got? All of them have settled and apologized. The Daily Telegraph is the one I think you refer to, which was my biggest victory. They had to pay me £150,000 in damages and £1.6 million in damages.
Why?
Because they falsely claimed that I was in the pay of the Saddam Hussein dictatorship. The same kind of smear, utterly baseless, gigantic smear, that they levelled at so many sections of the anti-war movement. What they can't take, you see, is that we were right and they were wrong. They were the bugle blowers for one of the most disastrous foreign policy decisions ever taken by Britain or America. And I was amongst those who was telling them that this is going to end precisely in the way that it has ended. And they don't like that.
Your comment on the latest, we know about the Abu Ghraib prison scandal from U.S. soldiers. You have your own scandal with British soldiers, and then the Guantanamo Guantanamo prisoners returning home here to Britain.
Well, you see, the ironclad consensus of the mainstream political parties, the front benches, and the BBC and the other mainstream media outlets like to reassure each other that this is conduct unrepresentative of British occupation forces. But I'm sorry to tell you, it's entirely representative. When Britain suppressed the Mau Mau freedom struggle in Kenya, they killed 100,000 Kenyans. Almost exactly the same number of Iraqis have been killed in the war and occupation. They used to cut off the limbs of Kikuyu tribespeople and pin them to the wall and take photographs of them. They used to pay British soldiers £5 per body for Kikuyu that they brought in. In Malaya, when we crushed the Malayan revolt for freedom, we killed 10,000 Malays. I've seen pictures of British soldiers holding the severed heads of Malay people for the cameras. This is how all occupations end. These things don't happen because the soldiers in question are American or British, any more than General Sharon's army behaves as it does because it's Israeli, still less because it's Jewish. They behave like that because they're occupying armies. And all occupations end this way. They end in the demonization, the subhumanization of the occupied people, a belief in the inherent superiority of the occupying forces. Otherwise, why should we be there reorganizing their societies? And that inevitably leads, when you're dealing with 17, 19, 21-year-old young men with weaponry against helpless civilian populations, it always ends in an Abu Ghraib.
British MP George Galloway. We were speaking yesterday in London. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we wrap up our discussion with Christian Parenti, author of the new book, The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq. Christian has gone to Iraq three times, most recently was in Afghanistan for their elections. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me back.
Your response to what has taken place in Iraq?
Well, I think that the Iraqi elections in many ways pose two problems for the Bush administration. One, to the extent that they don't work, and two, to the extent that they do work. To the extent that they don't work, that the Sunni population boycotts the elections and that they just become a fiasco and undermine the legitimacy of the new government, that thus undermines the legitimacy of the occupation. To the extent that the elections do work, and the Shia majority, as Robert Fisk was saying earlier, get power, that then poses problems for the U.S. It's entirely unclear what the two main Shia parties that swear spiritual but not necessarily political allegiance to al-Sistani will do. We're talking about the Dawah Party and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. In the past, they have said that they support Sharia law. Most of their leaders have spent exile time in Iran. And one of the key questions here is how, if the U.S. is indeed, as Seymour Hersh has indicated recently, ramping up some sort of destabilization of Iran, where will a Shia-led government in Iraq fit into all that? So it's not clear at all that the U.S. will be able to control the Shia. And it's important to remember that this election was in many ways forced upon the U.S. From the very beginning of the occupation, the Shia were demanding elections. And they were demanding elections of exactly this sort that would use the food rationing cards as a basis for the voter rolls. Paul Bremer, the civilian leader of the occupation before Negroponte, prevaricated for months, saying there now had to be a census, there had to be this, there had to be that. It wasn't until a year ago, January 04, when Sistani basically laid down an ultimatum and Shia hit the streets in the thousands and demanded an election and threatened to escalate, that the Bush administration capitulated and agreed to this UN-brokered election. So since then, the Bush administration has been trying to stage manage this and rebrand the occupation as it progressed.
It's interesting. Yesterday in London, I was on the BBC with the head of an organization called Republicans Abroad. She lives in London. And she was making the point that the Shia have basically promised that they won't put sheikhs in power. And that's why this is so good.
Well, I mean, yeah, who knows what's going to happen? I can't predict. It seems that the strategy at this point is to make the Shia political leadership feel threatened by the Sunni insurgency. There's been this spate of assassinations and assassination attempts, and probably to essentially blackmail the Shia into accepting U.S. occupation as the price of their survival. But the fact of the matter is that the Shia leadership and the Shia rank and file, all Iraqis want the U.S. out. And that problem is not going to go away for the U.S. So how it plays out, I don't know. But I don't think it's going to be I don't think this is an easy victory for the Bush administration.
Having been in Afghanistan for their elections, can you talk about the significance of these elections with U.S. forces in both places?
Well, the elections in Afghanistan were riddled with fraud, and all journalists on the ground saw that. Very little of it was reported. There's been even less access in Iraq. I mean, most of the election observers are in Amman. So the capacity for fraud in these elections is enormous. Likewise, the possibility of block voting is intense, where parties like the Dawah Party just turn out their rank and file to vote for the slate, and there not being a real contest. Another thing we've heard from people on the ground is that the government has been using intimidation to try and get people to vote. They've been saying that if you don't get your food ration card, upon which all this is based, marked, you might not get your ration, and everyone is totally dependent on that, and that might help explain some of the voter turnout. Also, we've seen immediately there's lying from the Iraqi Electoral Commission. They said the guy came out and said, "Oh, there's been 75% turnout." Then, when pressed on that, he backed down all the way down to 50 something possibly, and then admitted that this was just sort of a guesstimate based on people's impressions from the field. So I suspect that there's been lots of fraud. And by and large, the fraud will be used to boost Alawi's slate, because the U.S. definitely wants Alawi and his slate to have significant power in this new government to moderate the Dawah and the Supreme Council.
So on the one hand, you have areas of Iraq where the polls didn't even open, especially in Sunni areas. But you have very large turnout in Shia areas, including in Baghdad, large Shia turnout. Ultimately now, what this means for the United States and what this means for George Bush?
Well, at one level, it means nothing. They still have this problem of a guerrilla war that's out of control in central Iraq, but it could mean that there's a now newly legitimized Shia political force that will take institutional power and could undermine the occupation in in all sorts of interesting ways. I mean, George Bush said he would leave if he was asked. So the key thing is, of course, to get the government not to ask them to leave. And how they do that will, you know, obviously involve bribery and duplicity and intimidation. But it's by no means guaranteed that it's clean sailing for the Bush administration after this.
Also, in the midst of these elections, two planes down, one U.S. military, one British military. Looks like it yesterday turned out to be the deadliest day to date for British forces, with a Hercules plane going down. The militant group Ansar al-Islam claimed it shot down the plane. What do you think this means for the resistance in this case, but overall, the elections? Well,
I mean, I think that the resistance is...
you were, in a sense, embedded with them at certain points.
Yeah, I met some of the Sadr's guys, as well as Sunni resistance. I mean, I think the resistance is going to continue, that it has continued military success. The basic equation with this war is that the U.S. could only win it politically. It has completely blundered that side of it. An indication most recently, what you read at the top of the show, $8 point something billion squandered by the U.S. That was the type of money, that was the opportunity when the U.S. could have done reconstruction and won the hearts and minds. They've completely lost that side of the fight. Now they try to beat the resistance militarily, and it's hopeless. There's no way they can do that because the U.S. military already controls the entire country. So the problem is it doesn't control the population. And each move it makes, from laying waste to Fallujah to forcing this election down the throats of everyone, refusing to negotiate with the Association of Muslim Scholars, managing to alienate the Islamic Party, the mainstream Sunni Party, all of that just turns the population, the Sunni population, against the occupation. And even though the Shia have voted, it helps to alienate the Shia. So there's no military solution to this war. The war is going to continue unless the Bush administration, or whoever comes afterwards, completely transforms its methodologies and negotiates with its enemies and prepares to lose and prepares to cede power, which is not going to happen. So there's basically, I think we're just going to see the same type of deterioration of conditions, the same type of violence continuing. The one thing I think is important to think about is like the potential for a Shia-Sunni civil war. I always thought that was hyped in the U.S. press, and I think it is to many extent. There are huge tribes in Iraq that are both Sunni and Shia, but what you do have are minority sort of political vanguards on either side that definitely do have a beef with each other and definitely are at daggers drawn. And how that will play out, who knows?
Christian Perrini, thanks for joining us. His book is The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshroof, Abdul Qudus, Elizabeth Press, Anna Nagera, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. Happy birthday to Anna Nagera. Welcome back to Uri Gallet, and a very special thank you to Adam Howard and Angela Austin and Chris Zucker. Mike DeFilippo, Ryan Abernathy, and engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.